It's Wednesday, July 28th. Well, it was nice while it lasted. We start here. In a moment where the politics couldn't be more fraught, the CDC changes crucial guidance on masks.
People who are fully vaccinated, if they get sick, may be able to spread this to other people.
This won't just change policies around the country. It changes a lot about what we knew about this virus. We'll break it down. It's one thing to hear a politician talk about January 6th. It's another to hear this.
I could feel myself losing oxygen and recall thinking to myself, this is how I'm going to die.
What we learn from a day of dramatic testimony. And is it a safety decision or is it quitting?
The level of difficulty in what she is doing, she can die. I mean, that is not an overstatement.
How Simone Biles vaulted into a national discussion about sports, mental health, and what qualifies as gutsy. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. If the most consequential action of the year has been the rollout of vaccines to protect people from COVID-19, well, the most consequential announcement of the year was probably this one.
We begin tonight with that historic turning point in the pandemic in this country. Tonight, the CDC now saying no more masks for vaccinated Americans, both indoors and outdoors, even in crowds.
This was the CDC saying these vaccines are so incredible, so effective, that fully vaxxed Americans generally don't need masks anymore. They don't need them at work. They don't need them in school. They don't need them at birthday parties or concerts. People asked, wait, you must mean you can take off your mask around other vaccinated people, right? You'd never suggest I dive into a sea of people with COVID. And the CDC said, honestly,
if you are fully vaccinated, you can start doing the things that you had stopped doing because of the pandemic.
We begin tonight with the pandemic and the CDC's new guidance tonight.
Well, yesterday, in a surprise decision, the CDC said the Delta variant is so much worse than we knew at the time that even fully vaccinated Americans should be masked up again, at least in certain situations. So let's get into the nitty-gritty of this, because this is going to have implications for your health, your community, and your sanity in months to come. It also means you're going to start hearing everyone's favorite phrase again, viral load. We got a former acting director of the CDC with us, Dr. Richard Besser. He's now the head of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And so, Dr. Besser, in plain English, all that said, what is the new guidance from the CDC? Like, when should I have a mask on my face?
Yeah, so what the CDC is saying is that they've got new science, and the new science is leading them to change their guidance. And what they're saying is, if you're in a community that is having high levels or significant levels of COVID transmission, mm-hmm. You should be wearing a mask when you're indoors. And across the country, all kids, when they go back to school, regardless of whether they're vaccinated, all kids need to wear masks indoors, as do all staff and all teachers. Both of those are significant changes, but they reflect new science and they reflect the current situation in our country.
And so I get that we're clearly in a different place as far as case numbers, like that's changed. Cases were falling when they made this announcement, now they're rising. But that wasn't the reason we were told we don't need masks, right? We were told it's because these vaccines are just so freaking great that even if you're with somebody who might be positive, you're going to be fine. Like, has that fundamental idea, has that changed?
It has changed somewhat.
And what is different with the Delta variant than with the Alpha variant is that in those cases, those rare cases that we have breakthrough infections, we felt it important for people to understand that they have the potential to transmit virus to others.
What the CDC is saying is that they have done some outbreak investigations. And in those outbreak investigations, when they looked at the amount of virus that was in the nose of people who had not been vaccinated and were sick, and they compared it to the amount of virus in the nose of people who were vaccinated and were sick, it was the same.
Oh, and that's the viral load. The more virus you got, the more you can spread it.
Exactly. That's the viral load.
Now, importantly to convey in all of this is that of the transmission that is happening in the country right now, the vast majority of transmission occurring is occurring through unvaccinated individuals. But on that exception that there you might have a vaccine breakthrough, we thought it was important for people to understand that they could pass the disease on to someone else.
And what that says is that people who are fully vaccinated, if they get sick, may be able to spread this to other people, and that changes things.
But so that I mean, I just want to highlight for our listener, that's a huge deal, because that changes a lot of assumptions about how we've been treating COVID throughout this pandemic. So at this point, if I'm a vaccinated person and I get COVID, and we think that I'm more likely to transmit the Delta strain than I was with the original virus. I mean, does this change how we treat the breakthrough cases? Like, would I quarantine? Are we going to be self-isolating like in the old days?
Well, I think we'll have to see. This is new data, and they're making the guidance change based on what they know today. We have cases that are going up, and they're going to continue to go up. You know, thankfully, though, the populations that are at the highest risk of severe disease and of death, people 65 and older, we've done a very good job at getting people vaccinated. Mm. So we're not going to see the same dramatic rise in terms of death toll. But with 200 people dying a day, that number will go up. And most of those deaths are preventable with vaccination.
Hey, how does this affect? Can we talk about the significance of this guidance for schools? Because a year ago, we were saying, if it's dangerous enough right now that we should be wearing masks everywhere, well, certainly we shouldn't have kids piling over each other in classrooms, right? I can't believe I'm asking this. Does this mean that we shouldn't have our kids in school this coming September?
No, I don't think so. What we thought last year was that this virus would act very similarly to influenza. And for influenza, for the flu, children are a very important means of transmission within communities. What we see with COVID is that they're less important. Yes, they can spread it, but not in the same way as for the flu. And the other thing we see is that this illness in children is much less severe than it is in adults. Not to downplay that.
And this holds for Delta.
Yes, this holds for Delta. So the thing about Delta that's important to recognize is that while it spreads more easily, there's no evidence that it's more severe.
Got it.
So the fact that more children get sick means more children will end up in the hospital. But it's not because it's more severe. It's because it's transmitting to more people.
That's really helpful. Last question for you, because like we're talking about schools. Some states like Florida say they're actually going to ban mask mandates in schools, wherever. They're going to literally tell schools you are not allowed to follow this updated guidance from the CDC. So I'm wondering, like, you used to lead the CDC. Be honest with me. Did they shoot themselves in the foot here? Like, perhaps were they thinking, you know, at the time, there's a lot of variants out there. It's going to be really hard to have Americans put their masks back on if the guidance changes. But it's worth it because we really want people to get vaccinated. And this is kind of like an incentive to do that. We're going to play the calculus here. Did their calculus go wrong?
No. Yeah, I don't think so. This is the way science works. And it's the way pandemics roll out as well, is that as you learn more, you want to see that your guidance changes. This is not the last guidance we're going to see. Mm. There are going to be more changes to the guidance. And when those changes occur, you want to see what happened with this change occur as well, where the science is laid out. Here's what we see. Here's the new information. Here's why we're changing the guidance.
The president also saying in a statement, we are not going back to last year. More vaccinations and mask wearing in the areas most impacted by the Delta variant will enable us to avoid the kind of lockdowns, shutdowns, school closures, and disruptions we faced in 2020.
And I hope it leads more states to say, we're going to follow that, because CDC is not a regulatory agency. They can put out this guidance and every state in the union can say, thank you very much. We're going to do something different.
Right.
But they shouldn't, because this is the best guidance based on the science as we know it now. And hopefully as the situation changes and we learn more, as the CDC learns more, the guidance will continue to change at a rapid pace to meet that.
And speaking of rapidly changing guidance, ABC News has now learned overnight that the White House is reviewing whether it should actually require more federal employees to get vaccinated. And it now looks like President Biden will require all of them. That is 2.1 million Americans, whether they work in healthcare or not. He will require them to get a shot if they want to stay employed. This is the kind of thing the White House has said it did not want to start imposing. A lot of things changing very quickly. Dr. Richard Besser, following the science. Thanks so much.
It's a real pleasure, Brett.
Next up on Start Here, Capitol Police don't give much away about their politics, but it hits different when you watch your colleagues testify about the worst day of your life. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer.
We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
A quorum being present, the select committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol will be in order.
We knew it would be an emotional day on Capitol Hill. A committee devoted to examining the death and destruction of January 6th with testimony from the officers involved that day. So we knew this would be intense, but we still weren't prepared for this. ABC's congressional correspondent Rachel Scott was at the Capitol as this meeting began its investigation yesterday. She's at the Capitol right now. Rachel, we were seeing images of uniformed officers manning their own security posts in the building, like they work at the Capitol, watching their own colleagues testify. Like, what was it like in there?
Well, Brad, it was hard.
Thank you, Representative Cheney. I will now introduce our witnesses.
So for the first time, you had these four uniformed police officers testifying before Congress, and they told America in their own words what they witnessed on January 6th.
I, too, was being crushed by the rioters. I could feel myself losing oxygen and recall thinking to myself, this is how I'm going to die, defending this entrance.
You had Sergeant Gunnell saying that he thought that he was going to die that day.
In Iraq, we spent the armed violence because we were in a war zone. But nothing in my experience in the Army or as a law enforcement officer prepared me for what we confronted on January 6th.
This is a 15-year veteran of the Capitol Police who served 8 years in the Army, one of them in Iraq. And he said on January 6th, he was more afraid to work at the Capitol than his entire time on deployment.
Wow. We're still taking metal, sharpened objects, missiles.
And during this hearing, the House panel played video, some of it never seen before. We watched as Gunnell relived the experience where he was crushed by rioters. He was punched, he was kicked, he was sprayed with chemicals.
I arrived home at nearly 4 a.m. on January 7th. I had to push my wife away from me because she wanted to hug me. And I told her no because of all the chemical that my uniform had on.
And then you had Officer Michael Fanone. I talked to him leading up to this hearing. He told me that as difficult as it was going to be, he felt like he had to be there to get the truth out.
I was electrocuted again and again and again with a taser. I'm sure I was screaming, but I don't think I could even hear my own voice.
And then finally, you had Officer Harry Dunn.
I told him to just leave the Capitol, and in response, they yelled, "No, man, this is our house. President Trump invited us here."
This is a 13-year veteran of the Capitol Police, and he described in pretty graphic terms the reality of what it was like for a black man in uniform.
One woman in a pink MAGA shirt yelled, "You hear that, guys? This voted for Joe Biden." Then the crowd, perhaps around 20 people, joined in screaming, "Boo!"
He was called the N-word repeatedly.
I sat down on a bench in the rotunda with a friend of mine who was also a black Capitol Police officer and told him about the racial slurs I endured. I became very emotional and began yelling, "How the blank could something like this happen? Is this America?"
While you were holding back the mob at the Lower West Terrace entrance, I was holed up with Congresswoman Kathleen Rice in a small office about 40 paces from the tunnel that you all were in.
All the members of Congress on this panel really just taken aback by the bravery, by the honesty.
I think it's important to tell you right now, though, You guys may, like, individually feel a little broken. You guys all talk about the effects you have to deal with, and, you know, you talk about the impact of that day. But you guys won. You guys held.
Adam Kinzinger, the Republican, you know, saying democracy is not defined by our bad days, insisting that we will be better.
Well, if we're talking about Adam Kinzinger and these Republicans who were selected by Nancy Pelosi and some Republicans who were actually kept off the committee that were chosen by leadership, was the very nature of this kind of different because of who was and who wasn't on that dais?
It was. And, you know, I think Officer Dunn said something that was really striking and really stood out to me. He says that everyone is trying to get around saying that this committee is political. And he says that that's impossible, that the rally itself on January 6th was a political rally, that people came to Washington, D.C. to, quote, stop the steal.
Officer Grinnell, when you think about that and share with us the vivid memory of the cruelty and the violence of the assault that day, and then you hear former President Trump say, quote, it was a loving crowd. There was a lot of love in the crowd. How does that make you feel?
It's upsetting. It's a pathetic excuse for his behavior, for something that he himself helped to create, this monstrosity. I'm still recovering from those hugs and kisses that day.
And so many of the officers testified, speaking about how they feel like they were pushed aside.
The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful. My law enforcement career prepared me to cope with some of the aspects of this experience.
And Officer Fanone said that he felt betrayed by Republicans who have just flat out dismissed the violence that happened or who are now downplaying it.
But nothing, truly nothing, has prepared me to address those elected members of our government who continue to deny the events of that day. And in doing so, betray their oath of office.
He says that he felt like he went to hell and back to protect the people that are on Capitol Hill, to protect the lawmakers themselves. And he says now they are trying to convince him that hell doesn't exist or that hell wasn't actually that bad.
Yeah, you got the sense from Democrats that they were thinking, you know, forget where you get your news from. If you listen to these officers, if you just get the facts, if you watch this video, the facts speak for themselves. However, that's not how a lot of Americans get their news. They're not watching this in real time. And so if the narratives of where people are actually getting their information from, if that narrative stays the same, then you imagine a lot of perceptions will stay the same as well. Rachel Scott, there at the Capitol. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
This Olympic cycle has been defined by the unknowns. We didn't even know if they'd be able to begin. But Americans have known one thing all this time for certain, that we've got the greatest gymnast in history competing for us. Simone Biles, the GOAT.
So it'll be a different experience, but we're ready for whatever they throw at us.
And no one gets a crowd going quite like you. So.
Yeah, it'll be very, very different, but I mean, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. And because of Simone Biles' sheer dominance, doing stuff that no Olympic gymnast has ever attempted, ever, any team that she's on automatically becomes the runaway favorite. So Team USA, for years now, has had a swagger. Until yesterday, when Americans learned in push alerts that Team USA had fallen.
Heartbreak in women's gymnastics. Team USA failed to capture gold in the team sport for the first time since 2008.
They'd won the silver in women's gymnastics, while Russian athletes won the gold. The chief reason for this was that Simone Biles had withdrawn from the competition. And that's where this becomes more than about sports and medals and Olympic records, because it wasn't like Simone Biles broke her ankle. Rather, in what is essentially the first quarter of her sports Super Bowl, the star quarterback said she had a mental block and couldn't do this. Let's check in with Alyssa Ronick. She's a senior writer for ESPN. Alyssa, I mean, what went wrong here?
For those of us who, you know, watched this live and this was unfolding in front of us, you know, at first we weren't quite sure. You know, now we've had the perspective of being able to listen to Simone and understand what was going on. But essentially, she had been struggling.
Over in the gym, some rare early struggles for the U.S. women, finishing second in the team qualifiers as they aim for an Olympic three-peat.
Even Simone Biles facing some stumbles, posting on Instagram, "I truly do feel like I have the weight of the world on my shoulders at times."
throughout the day. The pressure had been mounting, and she had a lot of difficulty in warm-ups.
Today has been really stressful. We had a workout this morning. It went okay, and then just that 5.5 hour wait or something, I was just like shaking, could barely nap.
Their first rotation up was vault, and by starting on vault next to them, that is their strongest event.
I've just never felt like this going into a competition before, and I tried to go out here and have fun, and warm up in the back went a little bit better, but then once I came out here, I was like, no, mental is not there. So
there's also a thing in gymnastics that the gymnasts refer to as the twisties, and essentially what that, you know, you can have performed a skill 10,000 times in your lifetime, and suddenly you walk into the gym and you just can't do it. You don't know where you are in the air. And that is, you know, that's essentially what we watched happen to Simone on live television.
And wow.
Very uncharacteristic vault for Simone, but it looked like she got almost lost in the air.
The fact that that did not end in catastrophe and she was able to, you know, walk out of that vault was a big deal. I mean, that could have been catastrophic.
She was seen walking off the floor, huddling with her teammates, and then speaking with her trainer.
I promise you, you're fine. We watched you warm up. And I said, no, I know I'm going to be fine, but I can't risk a medal for the team, so I need to call it.
Obviously, she came back out right after and gave us a pep talk, which is very helpful because we probably wouldn't have got through it without her. But yeah, I'm really proud of all of us because we ended up doing what we needed to do.
And so then the rest of the competition goes on, right? The U.S. falls sort of further and further behind to the Russians, just because if Simone Biles is there, all indications are that, you know, USA is typically dominant. But she wasn't. What has the reaction been around, I guess, the gymnastics world and the wider sports world? And are they different, I suppose?
The difference that I've seen, I mean, first of all, I think the reaction has been largely supportive. We are in a world now where athletes are beginning to understand that they are human beings first, that they have agency over their decision-making.
Naomi Osaka, shocking the tennis world by withdrawing from the tournament, announcing she's taking time away from the court.
And, you know, Simone talked about in the post-meet interviews how, you know, an athlete like Naomi Osaka did inspire her.
So it's okay sometimes to even sit out the big competitions to focus on yourself because it shows how strong of a competitor and person that you really are.
And so I think from the gymnastics community and I think from the larger general sports fan, it has been incredibly supportive. I've seen from sports fans who are maybe a little less in the know about the sport, a question about should she have pulled out before the meet and let an alternate take her spot? And you know, I say to each of them, that was not an option. Once you compete in prelims, I think 24 hours before the prelims, a couple of days ago, that's the last opportunity to put in an alternate. Hmm. And she learned really quickly that she just wasn't going to be able to do it.
Well, yeah, and I imagine there's people being like, hey, you got teammates around you too. Not like suck it up and do it for the team.
You know, I think the suck it up, do it for the team does not work when you are talking about a sport where the level of difficulty in what she is doing, she can die. I mean, that is not an overstatement.
We're going to take it a day at a time. I know tomorrow that we have a half day or at least the morning off. So it'll be a good mental rest. And so we'll take it from there.
Well, all right, then. So if this is it, if this is the last time we see her in competition, what is the legacy of Simone Biles going to be?
You know, I fully believe that everything she does strengthens her legacy. You know, if her legacy is only medals, and I think if we have learned anything in the wake of the Larry Nassar revelations, it is not only about medals.
Olympic gymnast Simone Biles sharing that very personal story, saying she was also molested by team Dr. Larry Nassar.
We've done everything that they asked us for, even when we didn't want to, and they couldn't do one damn job. You had one job. You literally had one job, and you couldn't protect us.
We talked to athletes who have stood on the Olympic podium with many gold medals hung around their necks, and they have spent years trying to heal from the damage that the sport of elite gymnastics caused them.
This medal is all of them and the coaches, and it has nothing to do with me because they did it without me. Okay.
But at the end of the day, we did, though.
We really dedicated this medal to Simone.
Yeah, this medal is definitely for her because if it wasn't for her, we wouldn't be here where we are right now.
Yeah. I really do believe the way in which Simone has used her voice and has changed the culture of the sport, and even by making this decision, has also shown that if there is a cultural shift happening within the sport of gymnastics, it is coming from the athletes. It is led by the athletes. Even if she does not hang another medal around her neck, I mean, her legacy is cemented as the greatest of all time.
Right, and fascinating conversations, I think, happening around the country because of this, is speaking to her sort of power over the mainstream right now. Alyssa Ronick from ESPN, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciated it.
Okay, we're going to step away. When we come back, did you do something different with your hair, or are you just a computer-generated deepfake? Trust the sound of my voice. One Last Thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. Ever since deepfakes arrived online, they've been seen as a menace. Remember, these are computer-generated images so advanced that you can basically edit someone's face or voice into something that they were never actually involved with.
Deepfakes can go from funny to fraud or worse and be used as a tool for foreign interference in our elections.
Well, deepfake technology is also becoming a resume booster. For example, I'm about to do a spoiler for The Mandalorian, the streaming Star Wars show from our parent company Disney. So this is last season. In a dramatic moment, Luke Skywalker himself makes an appearance.
Are you a Jedi?
I am.
That is what appears to be a young Mark Hamill, digitally stitched into the scene, which is weird. Right? You know in your brain that this guy has not looked like this for 40 years, but here he is. And more films are using technology that blurs the line between real and deep fake.
I pray that I never sin again as long as I live, if I could just get out of here.
The Irishman aged Robert De Niro down to a young man again. A recent documentary added the voice of deceased chef Anthony Bourdain saying things he never actually said.
Come, little one.
This Mandalorian scene actually picked up some flack from critics, not just because of the concept, the weirdness, but because they said Skywalker looked a little haggard, a little glitchy. In fact, a YouTuber who goes by the name Shamook actually tweaked the footage and 4 days later issued a new deepfake that looked even better. Now we've learned Lucasfilm has actually hired Shamook to work for them. They've issued a statement saying they've been investing in machine learning for years. They're excited by the momentum it's been building. So far from being just a vehicle for disinformation campaigns, deepfakes will be on your screen, whether you like it or not. And if you already thought it was wild that Lucasfilm, like one of the world's most respected visual film houses, owned by Disney, would sign a YouTuber, the announcement from Shamook about this hire was actually just in the comment section of some YouTube video. Like, that was the rollout. So deepfakers, they don't play by your rules. Hit us up on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram at Start Here ABC. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.